You ready?
All right.
I'll go ahead and call to order for the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting Tuesday, March 29th. If the audience would join the board, let's pledge allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good afternoon. I'd apologize to anybody that showed up this morning and missed our 10 o'clock show. We had a couple of reasons we had to postpone until 2 o'clock this afternoon. So public comment, number one, this comment period is for the public to address topics on today's agenda. Not seeing anybody moving towards a mic. Agency reports, Department of Human Services, Darren Thompson.
Maybe Darren came at 10.
Maybe Darren came at 10.
He might be running late.
Next would be consideration of minutes from March 22nd.
Move approval.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any additions or corrections? Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Toot. Aye. Consideration of personnel actions.
Move approval.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Anything further? Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Toot. Aye. Consent agenda. Please add utility permit number 1654.
1654, is that it? Move approval with no changes.
Second.
A motion and a second for the consent agenda. Anything additional? Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Toot. Aye. That takes us down to public hearing items. And this is to obtain comments on the paving of the existing gravel road, Grant Avenue, locally known as 530th Avenue, from west 190th Street north 1.5 miles to the Gilbert city limits. And I'll turn it over to Darren Moon, our county engineer.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. A few comments before you open the hearing. Grant Avenue, of course, is a project we have in our five-year program already. I'll cover that later in this meeting during our five-year program discussion, but the reason for this hearing is the DOT has a paving point structure that if you don't meet 50 points on a certain road, you can still pave it, but you have to hold a public hearing to make sure there's no real opposition to paving the road. So that's the real purpose of this hearing.
What do you get points for?
Here's the five categories. We only have a local road, so that really hurts us in the points. It's not a farm-to-market road. So I consider us local with major development, which is the school at the north end. So we get 10 points for that. Current year ADT, the south mile is 260, so we do get 26 points for that. We don't do well with the closest parallel route. It's 1 mile, so we get 0 points for that. And average gravel road is about 5% truck, so we get 5 points for that. So we're about 41 out of the 50. Bonus points if you have to do assessments out there and charge the people that live along the road to pave the road. So as far as I know, we're not interested in doing that. So we're at 41 out of 50 for the points. The only question one's the ADT. You know, as soon as we pave that, it's going to be probably 400 or 500 vehicles a day, easy after we pave it. A lot of the Gilbert people, I assume, will take that too to get straight down. So that after we pave it, the paving points will be there, but you count them for the current year ADT, not the proposed. So I do want to point out that another reason I kind of wanted to have a hearing for myself, too, is get some public input, because there is some challenges on this road, especially with the bike lane and purchasing the right-of-way for that. It's been a problem in the past. We wanted a bike path through there for a long time, but we couldn't purchase the right of way, and you cannot condemn property for a bike path. So I sent this letter out to all the landowners and notifying them of this hearing and kind of showing them a typical layout of what the road might look like with the existing right of way lines here, and then a bike path, which we currently put on the east side of the road for a couple reasons. Here's the stretch. We're talking about paving. The City of Ames originally had in their plans to put their bike path on the east side, but the last minute through developer agreements, they switched it over to the west side. So they will be coming in at the west side. And the reasons we put ours, historically we wanted to put the bike path either along this railroad or along the road. We this whole property here is owned by one property owner, and they've been against that. Just an update there. I did talk with her yesterday. She lives in Iowa City. She has since turned that property over to her three sons and daughters and the trust. So it's in four different splits. But it has changed hands, so I haven't talked with them yet, so they could have a different opinion on the whole thing. The other issue is we have that drainage district tile that runs through the whole stretch, and we're trying to avoid putting bike path on top of that because that's just not a good situation. We have blowouts in the tile. So we did identify where that drainage district tile is, and it is about right here. Fortunately, it's not very deep for the majority of the mile. It's only about 4 foot deep. And so I think we could leave it there without replacing it for the most part. And we could put the bike path over here if we needed to, and we could still fix it. If we did have a blowout, it wouldn't get under the pavement. It might get under the granular shoulder, but not under the pavement. So
are you still talking east side, though, right?
The district tile's on the west side.
On the east or west side?
West side.
West side. Yeah, okay.
So that's why I put the bike path over here to avoid all that.
Okay.
But when we get down closer, this is the south end. When we get down closer here, if we move the bike path over to this side, it's a real tight fit through these older barns. And that district tile gets really deep through here because there's a hill. It gets over 10 foot deep. In order to fit the bike path through there and everything, we'd have to pave the shoulder and the bike path, and there'd be a lot of paving there over the top of our district tile. But for the time being, we've had proposed on the other side, which impacts this side and this side. And I have heard from three landowners on this side. Two of them are already opposed to the bike path in general. The third one, they were okay with the concept of a bike path. They're concerned about, let me zoom back into that one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, Mr. Shaw did show up. Good. He's for the bike path, but of course wants to minimize the impact of the trees and stuff in his front yard, I understand.
Sure.
So I assume you might speak during the public hearing.
Sure.
Not necessarily? Okay. But there is two other property owners that are opposed to it, so we start down that path and meet with them first and see if we can get an agreement, but if we can't, we're kind of stuck. We can try it on the other side, but it's going to be a challenge.
Bike path is occurring within the right-of-way or outside the right-of-way?
Let me go back to that trust section. That's just the existing right-of-way. We're going to have to buy out to here just for the paving of the road, and then the additional 10 to 15 feet for the bike path itself. So we'll buy right away out to here.
But whether we do the bike path or not, we've got to do more right away than we've got now.
Correct. Right. That'll be about 10 to 15 feet of additional just for the paving.
And so what's the minimum width of a bike path that...
For two-way traffic, which this one will be two-way, it's 10 foot. So there'll be a 10 foot wide paved two-way bike path.
What would be the expectation in the wintertime as far as snow removal on that?
We touched on a little bit when the school was here with their proposal, and that I indicated we probably wouldn't maintain it in the winter, and they didn't seem to have an issue with that. And I don't imagine a lot of school kids taking it in the middle of winter for biking. And the other challenge with the bike path along farm ground like that is every farm entrance, we got to design that bike path to take egg loads. So we have to really beef it up
through
everything. And then it also kind of creates a barrier. That whole mile does not drain well. It's not in real defined drainage ways, so it's kind of built up where the bike path is, so farm drainage getting off is a concern to the farmers. It kind of creates a barrier there.
Yep.
We'll have culverts under the spots to try to alleviate that, but it's so flat that it doesn't really, pull in one spot. couple of slides from disciplinary draft plans we put together. This is Moose Road 190th, south end of the project. In order to fit through these first couple homes, and there's also some hills, we actually put a paved shoulder on there, so we don't need a ditch at all. Paved shoulder with a little curb, and the bike path is the darker area. We're able to fit that in almost in the existing right-of-way when we do that. And then as soon as we get out of the two residents, which are both owned by the same property owner, then we head out to the normal cross-section where it's a separated bike path. We're still going to have to figure out, I'm going to talk to some people what the best way, what bikers come down here. We're going to have to get them across both this and that. This will be a stop condition southbound, so it's a good place to cross. Whether you push them up here, you have some turning traffic here, so you don't really want bikes sitting there waiting when you have turning traffic getting off there. So I'll figure out how we do that in rural areas.
So that's the part that seems to be the biggest concern I have, is trying to figure out if the city is on the west side and we're talking about the east side, there's got to be some avenue to crossing. And nobody wants to build a tunnel underneath the road. So that can be an avenue to go through. But, you know, or and I call a tunnel, it's really like a box culvert that's big enough that people and passengers could go under. But I think safety becomes a primary concern in the design if we have that.
Yeah, right now Moose Road will be non-stop condition, they'll be able to go through there, but it could always be a four-way stop in the future if need be. But the other issue,
what triggers it becoming a four-way stop here?
Well, usually it's based on traffic. You need to have about the same amount of traffic entering all directions. If you don't, it's better just to have a two-way stop. But
what do we have on 190th right now? Because it's our expectation that what's happening on Grant 530 of the Gretton is going to go up once it's paved. Right. What do we have on 190th going east?
I can't off the top of my head.
And the anticipation of four-way states is going to increase.
Oh, yeah. Traffic out there is going to increase in every direction.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing to keep in mind, right now we have the bike path on the east side. It matches in with the sidewalk. It's already there for the school. It doesn't show up in the photo yet because the photo was taken before the school was built, but we match in about right here.
Mm-hmm.
We're on this side. City limits is right here. Getting it through these backyards would be a challenge. There's a pretty good slope there, and they have a lot of trees and buildings up against the right-of-ways, but that would have to be a city issue on how they'd extend it up. And the stop sign isn't here, so I wouldn't want them crossing here. It'd have to be at a stop sign. So it's another good reason to have it on this side if we can get it done. But that's what we're going to try out originally. And if it doesn't work, I'll have to come back and try it on the other side. And this, if we put it on the west side, this is one house up on towards the north end. It's right here. That would be a tight fit through, and they have some large trees in the front yard. These two are questionable even with the paving, but these might have to go with a bike path went on that side, and they might not want it right that close to their house. They built fairly close to the road, so I haven't heard from them yet.
I'm right here.
You are here, good. Those are the main challenges for the bike lane. The paving, so far I haven't heard anybody opposed to the paving, but somebody could be during the public hearing. We'll find that out. And you're not going to take any action today. I'll put a resolution on the board agenda for next week, and that resolution needs to state who was for and against paving, and I need to send that into the DOT.
Now, of course, the property's on the east side. There is no deviation to the back side of a yard instead of going to the front of a residence. And usually you see this more in subdivisions where your bike path is usually at the rear of the homes. Has the varying feasibility or slope possibility of a deviation around some of those residential places?
just looking at the ag ground, it's going to be difficult to get around on ag ground, but that's a possibility. We've tried to do that on the west side for a number of years and just couldn't get the property.
I guess what I was thinking of is right about where the property line ends to the rear of the homesteads. Is there any legal area where your bike path could be diverted along the back side of some of those residents? I mean, to me, if I was a resident and bikes were coming in the back side, would be more ideal necessarily than in the front of my house.
Sure. Really be tough down here with Moose Road and everything, so that one would probably have to stick through there. Up here, it'd be pretty long ways around, but it's possible. All else goes. Try it. I'll show you a couple more of these pictures. This is the first row of houses, and then you move up to that second house here, and then the barns across the street. Again, we move in and do that paved shoulder again. That's for the bike path, and because we're cutting a hill down, kind of like we did on 13th Street, we put that paved shoulder with the slope curb on it to get us through the hill and not have to have a ditch in there. And then once we get back out to the farm ground, it goes back out. And the only other issue is further north, we have that large utility pole transmission line. We're going to have to come in around that as gradual as we can, but it's doable. Those are the main issues. At some point, I'm going to have to come to the board with a final set of plans. You're going to have to approve that before we can start buying right away. And I guess we can have those discussions, which side we think is the best way to approach first. But right now, we have it on the east side.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the feasibility of again, working with the landowners, the homeowners within that particular area, looking at the two different concepts that you're looking at, and looking at the maximum type amount of right of way that would be impacted? I mean, I can see, you know, some really amenities and some advantages of having not only bypass for the kids but adults and traffic. You want to encourage people to be outdoors and more active and recreation wise. And if you have this, I'm just trying to think in terms of ways to enhance the entire community in terms of outdoor recreation and biking, walking, etc., because not only could it be biking, it's a walking lane as well. So I'm just curious in terms of the process that we need to go through to kind of see if we can, you know, get some consensus among the folks in that area as to what their preference would be.
Along those lines, I do want to discourage paving the shoulders of bike path because the city of Ames portion is all going to be offset.
Right.
And that would really discourage children from taking it as a paved shoulder bike path. Mm-hmm. I want to keep it separated.
Right.
So, and the only thing I would add to that, Aaron, is if at all possible. Because the preference has to be that we've got off-street, an off-street path, right?
Right.
Keep it completely separated. But worst-case scenario is not on-street path. It's kids out there riding on the street with no path.
Yeah.
And what we've got to recognize is you pave this road, whether you give pedestrians and bicycles a place to go or not, they're going to be utilized. I mean, you drive towards Washington Harbor right now.
That's all I have. I'll let you open up the hearing.
Okay. With that, I'll open the public hearing. Anybody that has any comments they'd like to make on this proposed paving project, I'd invite you to come up to the mic and just state your name, and we'll go from there.
Remember, your ideas could be subject to change, but we'd like to hear what reservations or concerns that you might have.
Yeah. Constance Torzon, resident of Ames. I just have a question for background. Why did they choose not to put it by the railroad track as like a new part of like a park system and having a trail that way?
Mm-hmm.
Just curious.
I think they've had a problem in the past with land.
Securing land. Yeah, the idea for got here, the last 50, in fact, we had a grant through conservation that I think just expired to put a trail, Connie, exactly where you're talking about, along the railroad tracks, all the way from in Ames. I think it was going to run all the way from Bloomington Road north to Gilbert. I think that was the preference, and never could get agreement from landowners. And this is not an area that that government can acquire the land if the landowners aren't in favor of it.
Anybody else?
I'd like to hear from Lindsay. Lindsay, you came all the way over here. Maybe twice. Did you come twice today?
No, just once.
Okay, all right, good.
From the school standpoint, we're looking at it, and that's going to be a safer route.
Lindsay, introduce yourself.
Oh, Lindsay Beetzer, Superintendent Gilbert. From the school standpoint, we're looking at it as a safe route for our kids when you pay that. We are trying to do some different things, looking at grant possibilities, working with the city to try to help out with that bike path. We cannot use our PEPL funds because it does not fall within the school property. But we are looking at different opportunities for that. And again, as you said, I think you're going to see whether you have a bike path or not there's going to be kids that are going to be using it. So we want to try to make it as safe as possible.
That's the fear. And so we talked about this during our budget work sessions. Gilbert, both city of Gilbert and school system came over and talked to us during our budget work sessions with the engineer in, I want to say, was it January or was it January? In January. And what we talked through for this year's budget, this is strictly saying budgetarily there's dollars there. The county plugged in enough money in the budget to pave the road and to pay for one half of any path that might run north and south there. And the school system and Gilbert indicated, both the school system and the city indicated that they would work together to try to generate that second half of whatever cost there would be for any kind of path.
Right.
Anybody else? Jeannie, you made two trips. You might as well get up and say something.
Yeah, I'm Gene Upshill, live right north of Gilbert. I did come over this morning, along with Tom Judge. But anyway, I know a few of us came over maybe 5-6 years ago, I don't know, talking about this, and I'm certainly glad that we're at this point. And I happen to have land on both sides, up right south of Gilbert, both sides of this road. But I completely support what we're trying to do here. The road has been a lot of accidents on this road, and so there's no question about the paving part that is a good thing to do. And I also support a bike trail. I will have to say it doesn't run right in front of my house, and so I can understand why there might be some people maybe not quite as supportive as I am. But I just want to go on record that I support the project.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing. And this is not an action item.
And when does this come back to us?
What kind of, as a result of where we stand today with just having the public hearing and so forth, prior to you bringing this back to us, what things do you need to now factor in prior to, our next trip?
The resolution we have on the board next week is strictly for the paving point discussion, and that needs to be sent to the DOT just in order for us to program the project. Okay. And then at a later date, I'll bring plans back for the board to approve for final plans. And before that point, we can have more discussions on which side we need.
Well, and what's your expectation of that timing? So next week, we've got to go through the resolution. If that passes, that goes to DOT. And then when does the meat of the plan actually come? When do landowners need to really be engaged about which side a trail is going on, a path?
We could have those ready fairly soon, just a few weeks. When you approve that final set of plans, we can have the hearing at that point, but then that's a little late to make changes. So we could have a hearing in between than just to hear more comments, but that's why I was kind of hoping to get as many comments at this meeting as we could and give us a direction on which way to put it. But
well, the old saying is if you don't have a lot of objections, then you use your engineering expertise to come up with what you think is the best and safest route, and hopefully you would be in communication with the school district and so forth, because I think this ties in the city, because it ties in with, you know, their safe route to schools and all of these kind of things. So anytime we can partner in that type of dialogue and come up with a feasible plan that, you know, while it may not be perfect for any one of the three entities, but it's the best of all the alternatives would be the direction I think we'd probably want to consider.
Well, and Darren, based on what I know sitting here today, and the two things that impact me are the fact that we've got a drainage tile running the full length down the west side, and that the reality is the school is built on the east side, and they have a sidewalk already right there at the city limits waiting to meet this thing. It just seems to me that you got to cross somewhere. I mean, somewhere there's going to have to be a crossing east to west. We've already got issues at 190th with figuring out how to have people safely cross there. It just seems to me that we can figure out a way to make that one crossing and go. And so I'd encourage you, as you make the plans, when it starts to come back so that everybody can have a fair time to comment on things, that you be looking on the east side until such time as we find out that that's not practicable.
I can have some more discussions on the ones that were opposed to it and see. That's not the normal approach to buying right away, but it's kind of a unique situation with the bike path.
Well, it most directly impacts them. Again, I'm going to fall down on the side of the reality is once this road gets paved, assuming it gets paved, we're going to have other than automobile traffic on this stretch, and we've got to figure out how to safely do that. And nobody wants an unsafe situation out in front of their property or in front of their house, and so we'll figure it out.
Okay. Do a little research and come back and see. So yeah, quarterly report next week. That might be a little too soon, but I'll see if I can find out more by then.
But we put the resolution on next week so that we can send it to DOT.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Good. Okay. Very good. Thank you. I see Darren Thompson stuck in the back, so we'll hear from him with the DHS report.
Good afternoon. Did you move that up on me? I missed it.
Right. Yeah,
try to keep the gas.
Yeah, we had your first thing. Now your second thing.
Oh, you did it, didn't you? Excellent. Okay. Our report really doesn't have a whole lot of additional items in it other than the normal updates on our staff. We're pretty much full in that office, which we're utilizing all but maybe one of the cubicles there. We have a couple of turnovers with regards to staff in the support realm, and those are just the individuals that are helping us to maintain our daily items. DCAT CPVC has been doing exceptionally well. I think we've got a lot of great programs that are happening there. Natalie has been a real asset to the group, I think, in coming up with some interesting ideas in that particular area. One in particular is the trauma-informed yoga that we've had some really good success with a lot of kids, really trying to help them through some struggling times. So that's an exciting program that we haven't had any exposure to. And it's also getting some traction now in some of the other surrounding counties, which is a nice thing to know that it's going to start here and maybe spread to other counties.
And they've filled up pretty much every offering of that, right?
Every single one. They've got an additional offering that they made that I think they had 16 students signed up for, so there could be an opportunity to even do maybe one or two more before the end of this fiscal year.
And tell us who that's offered to.
It's offered for any students, and typically we want teenagers, those that have been struggling significantly with either troubles that they're experiencing at school, so a school can refer them to, DHS can refer, JCS can refer, so these can be youth that are struggling in multiple areas. And this helps them to gain a better trust and understanding of the environment that they're in, and also a better understanding of how to deal with difficult situations that they're faced with, either at school, at home, or in any other environment that they're trying to establish themselves in. We know youth are just struggling all around at times to have their voice heard in an appropriate way. And that's probably one of the biggest items that we see that happens. So the traumas that they're experiencing, a lot of times they're not going to talk about. In this environment, they can talk about those and also have an outlet for how to deal with that. A lot of kids with a lot of anger issues, anger at the world, anger at each other. This helps them to deal with that in a positive and reinforced way that we believe will be an asset to their ability to handle difficult situations in the future. A lot of good things there. We continue budget-wise to do quite well with regards to the DCAP finances. The legislature, of course, with the transition of several different key items, can and in the past has scooped dollars from DHS, which are dollars that can be utilized in the DCAT realm, and so that could put us in a little bit of a pinch financially moving forward. I believe because of good financial management, we're in great shape here coming up and shouldn't see too many issues at all with that. Child welfare, we're continuing to do exceptionally well there. Our income maintenance group has pretty much scored tops in the state with regards to some of their programs and being able to handle timely our applications and reviews, and that those are special programs that we're doing. That ties right in really well with our child welfare portion. We're consistently being ranked in the top third in the state with regards to timely seeing children, and then also being able to visit those children on a consistent basis so that we're assuring that the cases are moving forward quickly and we're closing them down. Of course, that is in conjunction with Story County's attorney's office, which has been a great asset to us in helping to ensure that we're making good decisions for these children and families that are suffering some hard times. The public assistance portion is at the very end of the actual document itself. Just gives you some 5 to 6 year trends of where Story County as a whole has been going. The total assistance, and this would be food assistance, the family investments, Medicaid, Title 19, has run in fiscal year 2010, $59,644,000 roughly, and we're up to, in 2015, $83,395,000. So, roughly, the office and staff that are here are helping to bring in to Story County residents approximately $83 million each fiscal year. We see that trend continuing to increase as Medicaid, Title 19 changes on a national level. That certainly changes on a state level as well, and we've seen that increase continue to go up year over year. We don't see that trend changing just as of yet. That is pretty much the report that we have available to you. Any questions?
Darren, we appreciate your work.
Appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you. I appreciate you fitting us in today on that.
Yeah, sorry.
I apologize for not being here right away.
That's all right. Next, additional items. Consideration of Resolution 1645, FY17 Appropriations Amendment. Lisa Markley, Assistant Auditor.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The appropriation amendment that I have in front of you today is for the non-elected officials for the departments. As you will recall, we did amend all of the elected officials' budgets, or appropriate 100% of all the elected officials' budgets, so those are already done. What I'm asking to do today is to appropriate the remaining salary dollars for the departments. So they are not 100% appropriate. Overall, they're not 100% appropriated, but the salary portions are. I'm also working on salary or amendments for the whole overall budget for the rest of the salaries for everybody, because we didn't budget 100% salaries.
Okay.
I can read them if you want, or you can read what's in front of you.
Anybody have any questions for Lisa?
No. This is what we said we would do. We said we would get to this point, and we would amend in the dollars necessary.
We're not amending, we're appropriating. But now we're going to amend after that,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I move approval of Resolution 1645.
Second.
A motion and a second to approve Resolution 1645. Is there anything additional? Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Two. Aye. That's been approved. Thanks, Lisa. And looks like next, discussion and consideration of adding 3 detention officer positions within the Story County Jail. Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald and his staff.
And all.
Some of this staff.
So, good afternoon, and thank you, Board, for hearing us today. As we work through our year with our personnel, we come into peaks and valleys, and occasionally with our staffing, we come into a valley where we run into issues of FMLA, people moving on to other jobs, and so forth. We had a situation recently where of our 9 detention officers that we have that work in the jail that are female, we're down 5 of those. We have 4 that are working carrying the workload right now. We've been doing testing where we've been recruiting for female-only detention officers. And that also, when we have times like this, it also gives us a reason to reflect and look at the entire staff and what is happening in the jail. And as we look at this, I'd ask Commander Offison and Assistant Commander Anderson to put together a brief presentation to the board so you can look at the numbers that we're sharing. When we first went out to the Justice Center, we were authorized strength. I don't have the exact number, but I believe it was just over 40. And when we moved out there, I had to do a little bit of stealing from the other divisions. I took 2 deputies from patrol and put them in the jail. I took communications personnel and put them in the jail. I took eliminated the DARE position that we had and put that person in the jail. And we ended up moving, I think, about 6 people from various spots in the sheriff's office into the jail so we could have enough staff to work. Well, as we continued to evolve, we backfilled the other positions, but we're still, to this day, under the recommended staffing that was made when we first moved out to the Justice Center. So anyway, so the board would have a fuller understanding of what we're facing right now, and not only in financial aspects, such as overtime, but also in the human aspects, such as burnout and fatigue that exposes the county to other problems when you have tired staff. So with that, I would like to turn this over to Commander Osmussen to start the presentation today.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You guys, just real quick, I just want to touch base with where we're at. I sent along basically showing where we're at for the next 4 months. We are still down those officers, those female officers, and it looks like that will be the case. There'll be we have 3 that we have out that are actually going through the recruiting process and hiring process right now, so we look to have them on board, but the training will take probably up to 3 months to get them fully trained where they can take the post.
So John, I'm just trying to make sure I understand what I'm looking at here. If you were fully staffed, nobody on leave or anything like that, you would have 27 fewer days off in the month of March?
For which one are you looking at?
First one. The one you showed us for the next 4 months, which you're looking at for March, April, May, June.
We would be having 27 days we wouldn't have. Those are projected staff shortages that we're short on one of the shifts. We have 3 shifts because we are 24 hours a day, so that would be 27 shifts.
27 shifts. But my question is it 27 shifts based on being fully staffed on approved staff members today, or is it 27 shifts based on you've never had enough?
It's 27 based on the actual schedule that we have over there right now. So the schedule that we have with everybody being gone, we have to fill those 27 shifts.
Okay.
Because of the shortages. Okay. Now, I wanted to bring up an important fact that in April, we figured this, but it looks like that's going to be even higher because we have this change of venue trial that is supposed to be starting on the 12th. And that means 3 weeks of overtime to man the front and run the courthouse with security, which is additional. That's going to be probably double that when we get into April here. And if we're already being as short as we are, it's going to be very taxing to try to be able to man that. Mm-hmm. So this, again, uncovers what it's been throughout since the 14 years we've been here. We've been constantly short. So I turn it over to Mike and basically do update our staffing analysis that we've done before just so we can break it down per shift, per person, so we get a full understanding of that before we go any further. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike at this point.
Hypothetically, the question that probably... I don't know if it's natural or if it's proper, but if we got a change of venue, which means that it's not a Story County case, they're coming here, why can't the jurisdiction that have that send some additional personnel to help us with the staffing of the security of that?
They are sending basically inside the courtroom.
Right.
That's going to be all their staffing. They're going to take care of moving that inmate in and out. It's their inmate. Because we know our building.
Okay.
So basically the security of moving him, transporting him, and also moving him back and forth to court, as well as the court appearances, as well as meeting with his attorneys, are going to be handled by them.
Okay.
We'll facilitate the building, but they'll actually be in the courtroom themselves. It'll be Johnson County.
Okay.
It's also a little bit like mutual aid.
Right. That's what I was...
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be times where we're going to have a change of venue, perhaps, and we're going to go to other counties, and we're going to be experiencing those same issues as well.
But I was trying to wrap my arms around, even there, even just with the manning the front area, you know, the 49, are we talking about 3 weeks, 2 weeks?
They projected up to 3 weeks because there's quite a few witnesses in this trial.
Right.
But, again, you don't know until the actual trial starts. It could all of a sudden, all right, how they're going to make their arguments.
Okay.
All right, then I'll turn it over to Mikey so he can basically go through that staffing analysis if you have questions about that.
Okay, first off, I'm going to hand out two pieces of paper to each of you. You probably already have these, but I want to make sure that we are all talking on the same page because there's several numbers there. Okay, my name is Micah Anderson. I'm the Assistant Jail Administrator at Story County Jail. I have completed a jail staffing analysis. As I went through this, I used the methodology created by the National Institute of Justice, or U.S. Department of Justice, National Institute of Correction, Staffing Analysis Workbook for Jails. And I have brought a copy of that workbook to leave with you if anybody would like to go through and check on that. Basically, at its simplest form, this analysis has you do two things. First, it has you establish how many positions do you need to fill within your jail. This can give you a figure of how many hours of labor do you need per year to fill all the positions. Obviously, we work 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and we don't close. The second thing it has you do is figure out how many hours a year does an employee actually work. This is calculated using a three-year average. I use the three-year average of all of our detention officer staff, supervisory staff, command staff within our division to come up with figures. What it does is it takes the hours that you're scheduled to work, be that 2,080 for a five-on, two-off person, or in the case of the jail staff, work 3 days off, 6 days on, it's 1,994 hours, and subtracts the days that they're off due to vacation, sick time, military leave, and a bunch of other factors, and that comes up with a figure called the net annual work hours. That's the actual hours that that employee is on the job, on post, actually working. That is shown on the green form that I showed, handed out to each of you. You see on the left side that a detention officer, a DO, works 1,994 hours, 0.6 hours per year. They don't actually work that. The average detention officer has 93.8 hours of vacation, 15.3 hours of comp time, 72.8 hours of sick leave, 48 hours of training that they're mandated to be in training instead of working on their shift, 76 hours of personal time used, and on average 11.2 hours of military leave has been taken during that three-year sample period that the staffing analysis had me look at. One other important number, and you can see it down here at the bottom, is in number 12, is 114.66 hours that the average position allotted of the 24 detention officer positions, there's 114 hours of unfilled time. That's time that somebody is not working because they are not hired yet or they are not trained. We're in the process of recruiting, testing, hiring, background check, and then training that employee so they can be on post and effectively filling that position. So that would give us, for the detention officer position down at the bottom, 444 hours of time that they are working, or allotted, I guess, per year of that 1994, but they're not being effective. So they're only effectively at post working for 1,549.9, so I'll say 1,550 hours in the demonstration. Everybody with me so far? Am I losing people in the numbers? From here on, it's just simple math. We'll take an example of one post during the day. We'll say APOD, which is our general population post in the jail. That's one officer in with 46 male offenders. And we'll say that's day shift. Obviously, like John said, we work three shifts a day. We'll just look at day shift for this example. 8 hours a day, 365 days a year. We don't close. I need to fill APOD day shift for 2,920 hours per year. A detention officer on a 60 rotation works 1,994 hours a year, ineffective for 444 due to not being here, not hired yet, being sick on vacation or otherwise. So they're effectively covering that post for 1,550 hours. Math, 2,920 divided by 1,550, I need 1.88 officers to fill APOD day shift. Any questions so far on the math or how this is working? Obviously, we don't have just one post in the jail. We have five posts, and they work three shifts a day. So to fill five posts, day shift again, we're not talking the whole jail. We're talking day shift, a third of the jail. We have to cover 14,600 hours a year. Divide that by that net annual work hours of a detention officer, that 1,550 hours. We get 9.419 officers per shift. And remember that, I'll point that out in a second. We're going to round that down to 9 officers a shift. The staffing analysis does have you round, but it does point out an important thing when you do round down, that we're rounding down 0.419 of a person. 0.419 of a person's hours of that 1,550 hours is 650 hours per shift per year that was not set out at the beginning to even cover. That's overtime from day one that has to be covered by somebody other than the staff that we've got hired if we have 9 officers hired. If you look at the sheet with the yellow on it, and I'm sorry for the people that have to look at it on the screen, it's kind of small, but you can see here on the right side, there's the day shift, second shift, and night shift allocation of detention officers. There's that 9.419 officers needed, rounded down to 9. And then over here is the actual allocation of what we have right now. I've got 8. We're making do with 8 officers per shift, 8 on first, 8 on second, 8 on third. So we're, you know, not even being undermanned with the 9. We're really undermanned with the 8, and that's where it sits today. It's also important to point out that this is the best case scenario. Even if I had 9.4192 officers per shift, that would be the sufficient staffing if we could handpick when everybody was sick, when everybody was on vacation, when everybody had their FMLA time, when everybody was going to resign, and spread that evenly throughout the year, which obviously that's an unrealistic expectation. We can't expect to do that. The sick time's going to bunch up during the flu season. Vacations are going to bunch up in the summer. We have no way to predict when people are going to resign, find new jobs, when FMLA is going to happen. So we have no say when it actually comes down. But this is these figures that we see, best case scenario. So how are we surviving right now? Obviously, I've shown the need for more staff. What are we doing right now to survive? First thing, supervisors are working the post. They're in court, they're taking trips, they're driving around, they're watching inmates, they're not watching officers, and they're not doing their supervisor jobs right now. Second thing we're doing, officers are working all shifts. Regardless of the shift they did through the union, they're working shifts other than that. They may normally work night shift, but they might have to work days one day, second shift the next day, afternoons the next day. That happened for the last year, 1,920 hours of that. People working shift other than what they had did through their union shift day. Finally, we're covering it with overtime. If you look at the numbers of the overtime that we're spending for the jail, that's where it's coming from. We're not staffed from the start to cover all the posts we need. Even with the additional staff that we're asking for, I can show that's not even getting us to the point where we could handpick it and get rid of all the overtime. And obviously we can't handpick when these shortages are going to come down. Mandatory overtime is the norm. Ask anybody that works in the jail division. Overtime is not something that's a perk anymore, or it's not a perk for them. It's something that's being mandated. So if you don't sign up for these posts, somebody is going to be forced to do it. Long term, this is not sustainable. It's going to be detrimental to our staffing. We're going to have staff burnout. We're going to have staff fatigue, which ultimately is going to end up for liability for us, the county. Errors can get made if you're working too many hours, if you don't get in regular sleep patterns, and John has more figures on that.
Last three things that you said that we talked about, the National Institute.
Oh, I got those.
Okay.
So, any questions on the staffing analysis that I have put together?
I want to make sure I understood you. If you were, what you're suggesting, fully staffed, so 9 officers per shift, you would still have 650 hours per year of overtime.
Per shift per year.
650 per shift. So each of the three shifts.
And that's if I could handpick it and spread it out as evenly as possible, which we can.
And do you know off the top of your head how much overtime we had last year?
What do you want, hours or?
You tell me whatever you want to tell me.
I'll
ask you if I.
Spending was 95,000 in overtime. Hours was roughly 2,500 hours.
And that's just your division?
Division.
So 2,500 hours, but you're telling me there's almost 2,000 hours built into the process, right? So we were 500 hours beyond what's built in if you're fully staffed.
Probably, yeah.
I just want to make sure I understand what you're...
The staffing analysis shows 9.419.
Right, and you're saying
round
nine.
Down.
Right, and that's how you got to the 2,000 hours, 650 times 3, right? But you're telling me, so 2,000 hours is baked in. Even if you're fully staffed, you're good to go, you got 2,000 hours of overtime that you're going to have.
With 9, that's what the staffing study is showing us, yeah.
But we're only at 8, and we only had 2,500 hours of overtime last year. So help me reconcile that. Clearly, we're not fully staffing each shift. Just talk me through that.
Part of it comes from, if you look at the hours that people work, the jail administrator's working more hours than normal. He's covering posts, he's covering shifts. I'm getting pulled out, I'll go to court, I'll take a trip. Our supervisors are taking trips.
So we're eating up more than the 2,500 hours, we're just doing it.
We're covering it, and we're also covering it with moving people off their shifts. who has taken the time that the shift that they had did and say, you're not going to work nights today. I'll need you to leave at 3 o'clock, and I need you to be a factory 11. Okay?
All right. So basically, what Mike is showing there is we've got, for our actual staff that work the posts, there's 24 officers that actually work those posts. Okay?
8 per shift.
Correct. Connie, I had her run the numbers also, and that we've always been short people because we overturn. We basically go through a lot of people. So this last fiscal year, we were fully staffed one pay period. So we're not at 24, we're at 23. We're always basically have somebody's left.
Sure, that's the whole 94% thing here.
Right.
That we have the conversation right during budget time, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So then for us to train somebody, it takes 3 months to do that. So then basically you're actually down another person because usually somebody's always in training and they don't count. So we can't count them either. And then the last one would be that what Micah showed was that we are basically bumping people, which is probably the biggest factor with the burnout is people are, I bid second shift, but I'm working thirds and firsts, and I just don't know when, you know, one day I'm there, next day I'm over here, I get 8 hour turnaround, and I have to come back and work another post. So, and that's where it leads to, where we just want to make sure it is a 24/7 post. Our officers work 6 days on, 3 days off. They're getting burned out. As we've, 14 years now, we're continually getting more and more officers. We're getting more and more where they're burned out because of when they're working a post, an officer basically is subject to constant verbal abuse, manipulation, intimidation tactics by the inmates. Officers face the threat of violence constantly and must maintain a high state of alertness with the inmates they encounter on a daily basis. Officers are required to develop and maintain an ongoing positive personal relationship with the inmates and set constant boundaries. This constant state of alertness is extremely taxing both psychologically and physically. And now we add to that another 4 hours that your normal 8 hours that you're working and make them continue to do it by overworking them. That's where we're getting into the liability side, where we've had in the past to dismiss a few people because of that. It's beginning to show itself again. The physical aspect of it. You're working on basically walking on concrete, standing on concrete, working the whole day. Now you're an 8 hour shift, now you're working 12 hour shift, so you're taking more of a physical beating too as well. And then you work 12 hours and then you get an 8 hour turnaround, you come back on a different shift, so now you're already tired and you have to come back and do it again. So we're putting that officer with their, again, aspect of just being totally just burned out. This directly affects our work environment in the jail. What we see from it is it decreases our employees' commitment to the sheriff's office because I'm working so many hours that to a point where I can't get a day off, I can't go home, I start hating everybody, hating the place. That has a direct effect on us for their performance, as well as we have seen officers withdraw from interacting with other officers, start to become too familiar with the inmates or doing other things, and then it just has a negative impact on their work environment. We also have seen the sick leave, the absenteeism start to increase. So we're seeing more and more this is becoming a liability issue. That's why we want to bring it to your attention again, in that, like Micah showed in the study, this is not sustainable long term. We need to do something. So that's why we wanted to bring it to your guys' attention. And when I was going through all the articles, there was another important let me bring it to you. There was a 2000, I read one of the articles, and basically the department, this is in 2013, the U.S. Department of Justice Diagnostic Center had a study. In that study, correction officers have a higher rate of suicide, 39% higher than those of other occupations. On average, the life expectancy of a correction officer is 59 years old. Corrections officers experience some level of post-traumatic stress throughout their career. That is listed at 31% of correction officers will suffer from some form of PTSD. So these are factors that, as we continue to add that on to, we got to make sure we're taking that into consideration because we are seeing that happen to our people.
How many pods do we have again?
There is a general population pod, which is the 46. There is a housing control side. Then there is booking. Booking has inmate workers as well as everybody that's taken in for that fresh off the street to have higher propensity that we don't know where they're at medically, physically, anger-wise, so they take more constant observation.
Okay. And is the number of detention officers that we have in proportion at all to the number of inmates that we have?
It's more in proportion to the number of posts we have due to the design of the jail. We have five mandatory positions within the jail that we need to have filled. One of those being APOD, my example, 46 male officers in one unit. One of those being what we refer to as housing. That is higher security males in smaller units covered by one officer. We have master control, which is the control room that runs all the cameras indoors. We've got that to three. We've got booking, which covers all the intakes and releases and watches the people that are newly arrested. And then finally, we have one position called Rover, which goes and helps whoever needs help at the time. So those are the five minimum positions that I have listed out on here as our five spots that I need to have filled.
And that's really regardless of whether we have 10 inmates or 50 inmates.
Correct. We still have to run booking unless we're going to empty out 46 men and from APOD or the other. We can't put the females over there from housing, so we have to run. They have to be open all the time, all of us.
So we're talking about down the road. I saw in our capital improvements plan we're talking about doing some jail renovation. We're talking about justice center renovations and jail renovation. When we do the jail renovation, we're going to have to move our inmate population somewhere, right?
That's correct.
Tell me about that. So what I'm trying to get to is at some point, the amount we're spending per inmate becomes astronomical. I don't know that we're there yet, but I want to start to learn whether we're there yet. Just help me through that process. I mean, clearly, Sheriff, I don't know, when our jail first opened, I think you, as I recall, you took a lot of immigration,
U.S. Marshal
kind of thing, and I don't think we get near as many of those. I don't know what we're running now in terms of where we were capacity-wise at one point, but do you ever look back at the jail and think, God, we got a lot back there. We're spending more than we're utilizing.
Well, when we look at the average cost to care and keep for an inmate, we look at that. We've been pretty consistent over the years. And the way we came across are how much we figure that we spend on inmate care and keep each day is a formula that we follow from the U.S. Marshal Service. And they help us put that together. When we first moved out here, we were in a process where we had a 48-bed jail upstairs that the jail inspector came in and said he didn't know how that got categorized that way, and he reduced it to 31. So we were housing inmates, starting to house inmates in other counties, and the courts also handled it like a reservation, where instead of sending a person straight to jail, the judge would order them to make contact with jail administrator, and then make a reservation for them to come in and serve time. And then we finally got evolved where we had the jail built, and we had excess space, we thought, moving in. Of course, when we moved out 118 inmates in a 96-bed jail. So after we got caught up with the backlog reservations and everything, things started to level out. We had an excess space, and we have a contract with the United States Marshal Service. And the first year that we had that contract in our new facility, we brought in close to, if I remember right, $650,000. And that was a great boon to the county. The problem is that with changes in directions in the United States Attorney's Office, the types of crime they go after has shifted, and that lowered their population. The Marshal Service, when the Polk County built their jail, they had an agreement with 50, I think it's 50 beds that they have for the United States Marshal Service. So they take the first 50, and any more where the U.S. Marshal Service used to have to bus their inmates to Fort Leavenworth to hold the overflow, that's just not the way it is anymore. Polk County will suck up the inmates, the initial inmates, and there's really very rarely do we get a U.S. Marshal inmate. The ICE, Immigration and Custom Enforcement detainers, there was a federal lawsuit out west. I know Hardin County is holding a lot, Marshall County is holding a lot, but the lawsuit out, I believe it was Oregon, the federal court came back and said holding on a detainer, and paraphrasing here, is basically a violation of an individual's rights.
because in this country, to hold somebody against their will, you must have probable cause or a valid arrest warrant. And a detainer is ICE and Immigration Custom Enforcement asking us to hold somebody without either of those for an extra 48 hours while they try to do some backup investigation. The court ruled they can't do it. So most jails do not honor ICE. I'm on White House Immigration Task Force, and that's one of the issues we're working on how to resolve that issue. But as it stands right now, there are a few sheriffs that say, well, we're going to hold them anyway. Well, I believe that exposes Story County to unnecessary liability. And as sheriff, I'm not going to hold anybody that I don't have a constitutional right to hold. So
we've got a 96-bed facility there right now.
No, we've expanded from a 96-bed facility to we did a modification early on and moved out here to a 104-bed facility.
We've got 104 beds, and what is our average inmate roster?
We're in the mid-70s right now.
Yeah. And that fluctuates. The last few months, we've been low. But we also started taking on Dallas County inmates to help them out because, you know, the condition they're in. But then there's times that we peak. But we really never have a constant, this is our average number. It's a very fluid number that we have that we look at for an average.
I completely understand the problems with mandatory overtime. Been there, done that quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Over 30-year career there, so I understand that. My problem is your timing. We certified our budget 2 weeks ago, and I'm not sure what ramifications three additional employees will have on a budget that's already been set that we didn't budget for. So that's my biggest concern. I don't disagree that the need is probably there. I'm convinced that you think you probably need more than three, and you thought three would be a doable number with the board. So there's got to be a happy medium in there someplace. If you spent, or the county spent $96,000 last year in overtime, that's one plus however many full-time employees that, and up to a point, overtime is okay. If you're a young single person or a young family man, a little bit of overtime is okay. The constant required overtime, mandatory overtime, it's exactly what John said. You come to work, you resent coming to work, and that just leads to all sorts of problems. When a peace officer, a corrections officer, resents his job to the point that he doesn't want to be there. So
I would like to follow up a little bit with Paul and just say that I sure appreciated the Board of Supervisors in Story County. The board, through my years, has always recognize the responsibilities that we have at the sheriff's office. And if we've had a need, we come to the board, and you've always worked with us. This is one of the things that, you work with it as best you can, and then you get stung, and you think, well, it's time to, bring the message forth again. And when we were down that many female officers in our pod, that was kind of that sting that we had. So the timing, I agree, is not right. I understand the fiscal responsibility is the board and the board's alone. But we bring this to you today for informational purposes, the request. Our people are working hard and doing the best they can. And however the board can work with us, either by additional staff or the mere understanding of what's going on, and we're going to have to eventually do something. I recognize that, and I appreciate the board's willingness.
In reference to the additional staff, the three numbers you threw out, but you highlight the need for females. So is that where the most critical need is? And so if you were somehow going to be increasing staff by one, two, or three, that would be the population. And does that mean that these are part-time or full-time, ignoring the training and ignoring everything else that goes into that? How do you factor in? Because there are times that you're not going to have that many female prisoners.
Female people work all posts in the jail.
Okay.
We are not of a facility where only females can oversee the females. But we have to have a female to do a search when they're brought into the jail, to pat them down and to do things like this. When we do transports, if we have somebody that we have to take, we try to have a female there unless we can have them segregated in another fashion. And we have that with the van and things of that nature. But it's not uncommon to go back into the jail and go into APOD, which is a 46th person unit that's all male, and have one of my female detention officers working that post. So...
So based on your total 84, 85, whatever we're at now, with the layoffs, fraternity or military, are we saying that we are somewhere in the neighborhood of 82? Or
I don't understand your question.
Looking at total staff that you have in jail.
FTEs and one part-time.
And so with the time off or different thing, the time that you're going to be less than that.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why you haven't been on the shift. So right, as of today, what is your total today?
Well, we'd count down the positions we're absent. We have two positions that I have conditional offers out to two females. We hired a third female or another female about 2 weeks ago, and she's just into her training cycle right now. We have two other females that are out on FMLA leave at this time, and one when she gets back. From her medical FMLA, she's going to be going out right away again because she's having a baby. So, I mean, these are things that, you know, years ago we didn't have really anybody on military. But now we don't discriminate against our troops, so they're hired. So they have military leave that they take. And it's that's something that comes up and we just deal with.
Well, you gave us four options, and then Sheriff, I appreciate you saying, you know, one of the options is for the board to recognize that this is tough timing and, you know, appreciate what you guys are going through and try to work on it. But one of the ones we haven't talked about is the possibility of hiring multiple part-time, non-benefit, receiving individuals to fill some of these positions, which in theory anyway would give us a greater pool when it comes time to fill one of our full-time positions. Talk that one through for me.
We've considered that and we've had that discussion. And where we're looking at, we had looked at coming to the board with a possibility of asking for 9 part-time people. And what that would give us is approximately 3 people a shift to be able to draw from. A concern that we did have is, even though they're part-time, they're going to have the same training. And you're going to have to also almost guarantee them certain amount of hours. And I say that from the standpoint is that the jail is a job of repetition, many parts of it. And if you don't work booking for 3 weeks and you get called to do an overnight and you're there and you think, how do you retain what you were trained? And so that was my thoughts anyway. John and Micah had brought that discussion to me and you guys have any other thoughts that we had on that?
Well, we have the issue of trying to find somebody that's going to work third shift, part-time hours. I mean, possibility, and then also second shift. Micah has to, with juggling everybody on all these shifts, he has 12-hour shifts, has 8-hour shifts, he has all these different things he's got to try to juggle, and then you're throwing in part-time shifts, again, where somebody, it's a nightmare. But it's something I'll let him, I know he had some other things that he had come across. I think the biggest thing is being able to find, and like the sheriff said, keep people to where they're at the level they can actually work the posts for each shift. I think day shift would be, that's definitely something we we could do.
Well, see, I think just the opposite. I think that night and overnight would be something. I mean, if you're talking about working somebody basically 2 12s a week, right? They're part-time. They're working 24 hours a week. I would. I mean, we got 36,000 students over here. That, I mean, you know, I don't know that they would qualify for what you guys are looking for. But you pull 2 nights a week. I mean, you know, I know I loaded UPS trucks overnight when I was in college. I think that those would be easier. I mean, we're caught in that, you know, Story County was just named the place in the country with the lowest unemployment rate for the month of January. That makes it tough for things like this, so we got to be a little creative. The other thing that I see in the possibility of doing something like this, it's much easier, from my perspective, for the board to approve a part-time position in this kind of climate. Than it is to approve another full-time position with where things appear to be headed fiscally the next couple of years. But it's also a little more creative, I think, in that you've got a chance then to build your pool to hopefully be able to draw a full-time detention officer from that when you have an opening. I don't know, maybe I'm way off base, maybe it's not even worth exploring. I was wondering why you guys didn't hit that a little harder.
Well, we did hit that. It's kind of like one of the changes that I made when I first became sheriff is that's how we moved from when I was first elected sheriff and took over 93. We had 36 right. sworn deputies, and today we have 30.
Right.
And the reason is because everybody in the jail was sworn. And so we came up with the idea of making the jail a truly civilian position and not a sworn deputy position, which saves us in training and money and a variety of things. And the first thing we had was naturally the fear that, you know, was who wants to be a detention officer, because it's always been the step to get to be a police officer or a deputy out on the road. And so we worked it up, and when we did the applications, we were amazed of the number of people that came in that said they wanted to be corrections people. They didn't want to be police officers of the street, and we already just thought just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to apply some of that here, and we were looking at the part-time work. And again, a little bit of fear comes into it, the unknown. We've not done it before. But also looking at there are certain standards of liability, and it's, you know, when I went through college, I, you know, did work study, and I had part-time jobs and all this that I worked as well. And it, working in a jail environment, I have a little bit of concern bringing somebody in on a part-time basis when you're dealing with some of these people. And as you know, I had some personnel issues in the last few months just with full-time staff. I mean, it's something that you really got to be on top of. And, you know, students in and out, and I'm just not as comfortable looking at a part-time.
I think that's completely reasonable. I mean, I think so. It's definitely outside the box,
mm-hmm.
but then I come back the other way and I say, if somebody could commit to two shifts a week, I think you could have them try. I mean, I'm not talking about somebody coming in and working 4 hours and going. And maybe, mm-hmm. you know, you're the sheriff. You gotta run that place how you see fit. We just got to figure out a way that we can fiscally manage the way that place needs to
be. And you know, these are good points. And working, like, have somebody come in and work two 12-hour shifts a week, but we also have union issues. And our overtime that we have, that they would come in to fill vacancies, you know, if we had people, we would call in and say, hey, detention officer Smith called in sick today. Can you be here in a couple hours and work that 8 or 12-hour shift? That's no problem. But there again, what concerns me is then you're getting back where you're trying to fill these leaks in the dam with part-time people. That's where you start losing the cohesiveness of coming in on a regular basis, on working these posts and learning them, and also learning the manipulation of the inmates that we deal with back there. I haven't actually, you know, worked as jailer for some time. These guys do it every day.
Right.
And, you know, staffings and information that's brought up to staff and things that we're going through not only with the inmates but with the staff itself, it's It's something. But I would, you know.
Because yeah, like I said, our training process, it takes about 3 months just to get somebody properly trained, and then to do that, with it would be quite a challenge.
Yeah. Alyssa, is there, what's the, if you want to hire somebody part-time and you don't want to give them benefits, what's the
part-time
29 hours?
No, you have to be by
29.
Yeah. As far as part-time,
you don't pay them benefits. There is a measurement period, and if you have to count their hours. So I constantly count the hours of all our part-time employees and see whether they qualify for benefits. We have a 12-month measurement period, so we look at 12 months. If they average 30 hours or more a week, then they would be eligible for benefits for the next 12 months. It doesn't matter how many hours they work. So with the part-time detention officers, if they want them to fill, you know, somebody calls them sick, they're already working two shifts a week, they have to be extremely careful pulling them in for more shifts. You have to take into consideration what is that going to do with your average hours for that. It would not only create a scheduling nightmare, I think, for the sheriff's office, it would also create a little additional work for us to continue looking at it and see where we're at for those employees. Mm-hmm. Part-time positions are very hard to fill. We found part-time positions, and they're during the day. So our candidate pool is a lot smaller. Most individuals want full-time employment. They do see the part-time employment as a foot in the door. So as soon as we get them up and trained into the part-time position, a lot of times we'll see them transfer into a full-time, which wouldn't be a bad situation in the jail because they'd have them trained, and they'd be able to fill that full-time role immediately. But I think you're going to see a fairly significant amount of turnover in those part-time positions.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I think what Mike had brought up, too, about how we would try to plug them in, but things change so quickly, and they say, hey, I need somebody to cover the shift. We wouldn't get that ability if we got to watch the hours so closely. Because he's every day, it can change. I mean, as soon as he posts it for the next month, that very next day, all of a sudden, things change. Trial or something comes up, and it's just like, wham.
Okay. Well, I think I'd like to know a net cost. How many dollars the board would actually have to find in next year's budget to do this.
Would you want to see, we've got detention officer per, if you want to see the cost of just a detention officer.
I think what I'm asking is for you guys and probably Connie to work with Lisa Markley and take a look at what we budgeted to spend in over, because this has to have an overtime component if we're looking at a net cost kind of thing. And I'm going to, so I mean, you got me peaked on the liability and the burnout and the realities of being a detention officer. Now I do what I do, and that is put on the numbers hat and try to figure it out. And so I just ask you guys to work with Lisa Markley and give the board a true look at how many dollars we're going to have to go find to do this or some version of this, and then let's just work together and see. I appreciate you showing us what the next 4 months look like. They look like that regardless of any action we take today, right? I mean, if we said go today, you're still dealing with what you're dealing with the next 4 months. Let's just move through the process and see what kind of costs we're looking at and have this conversation again with those numbers attached.
Thank you.
This was a consideration item, but we can just not take any action on it, and we can postpone this.
I'm just asking. Well, we just add more, you know.
Right.
More,
and they'll bring it back. We'll get it on the agenda and bring it back after discussion.
Right. Well, we appreciate very much the board listening and being willing to work with us. And we understand it. You can't go to a grocery store and buy $120 worth of groceries when you only got $100. So thank you very much, board. Appreciate it. We'll look forward to hearing back from you after we
send the information over to Lisa.
Thanks. Okay, next is discussion and consideration of employee assistance program through Employee and Family Resources effective July 1st, 2016. Alyssa, what do you want?
Thank you.
really to wing it back.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
What you see in front of you is a proposal for an employee assistance program. Just a little bit of background. We do have a employee assistance program. It's a very small benefit for our employees that you currently receive through Cigna. Since we do have long-term disability with Cigna, we do provide that. What you see in front of you is a more robust program. We've been looking at this for a few years. I did include something in the budget for next fiscal year to kind of ramp up our employee assistance program. We did take it out, obviously, for bid. We had a few other bids that came back. Cigna had a little bit better program than we're currently getting from them. We also got something back from Aetna. Employee and Family Resources did have the best program, in our opinion, to provide for our employees. If you look at it, it gave us a few different options. What I'm asking the board to consider is just the core program. It would include the 6 in-person assessments and counseling sessions per person for each issue per year. One nice benefit is not just for the employee, it's also for those living within their household. So it could be spouse, it could be children, anybody living there. They have a few other items on there. They have telephonic life coaching, financial consultation, elder care resources. One of the main things that we currently do not have included in our EAP would be on-site crisis response. Honestly, I hope we never have to use it, but we have it. Watch the news, you know, with the 2 Des Moines police officers that were involved in an accident. That would be a situation where we would need a resource to bring in for our employees. Another component is a management consultation and referral. So we have employees that are struggling with work issues, you know, performance issues. Instead of diving into their personal reasons, which I prefer that the supervisors don't do, we do have a management referral, and we can send them to talk to somebody. We budgeted $6,000 for next fiscal year. This came in at an estimate of about $5,500. So it was under the budget amount.
Okay. Iago, I believe it's the right thing for us to do. I like the idea of starting with core. I don't have any interest, nor do I believe it's appropriate for the board to know specifically who utilizes this, but I would like to know numbers. I would like to know what, you know, how many of our employees are utilizing one of these services. And I'd like to have it in 6 months so that we can have this conversation in January when we're in budget time of next year. So if you're talking about $21.60 per employee that we're going to be putting in, I'd like to know what kind of utilization it is, right, and what the actual cost is per employee that's utilizing any of these services. But I think it's worth doing. I think it's the right thing to do for our employees. And so I'll move approval of the Employee Assistance Program through Employee and Family Resources.
Second.
There's a motion and a second to approve the Employee Assistance Program. Is there anything further?
Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Two.
Aye. That's been approved. Next is the discussion and consideration of classification and compensation policy prior to a 7-day review.
Thanks, David.
Thank you. I'll be back up in just a few minutes. What you find in front of you is a draft policy that I'm bringing to the board for consideration. Currently, our compensation policy is one page. There are just a few items on it. It doesn't really cover any of the specifics that are covered in this policy. That other compensation policy has been in place since, I believe it's 1993, so it's outdated. What this policy does, it kind of explains what type of compensation plan we have, how that is, how positions are put on, whether they're put on a compensation plan with a min-max, whether we have a scale for certain positions, somewhat similar to what we find in our bargaining contracts. Mm-hmm. It also gives kind of a outline of how, at what wage do we bring employees in, what type of pay increases are they eligible for. We may have situations where we have promotions, lateral moves, demotions. And then the other one that we have had happen that we did not have a policy that covered was if we have a director leave, how do we handle any interim director compensation? How do you appoint that? Items like that.
Well, it provides a framework for operations, and you know, I was reading through it, and I kind of said to myself, you know, Evelyn, how we've functioned up to this point, and like you said, we had a short, a much briefer outline, but I think for anyone looking at this or an employee, you know, it would be easier to help explain when we have questions about some of the decisions that we have to make as we, you know, begin to plug in on the compensation schedule for the different things that, you know, we're talking about as we move forward in the future. So I see this as a real needed document, and I really appreciate the time and effort that's been put forth. But I kept thinking, scratching my head, saying, you know, we've never had anything like that.
The biggest struggle we've had is you know, we hire an employee, and then how do they move through that pay
rate?
Or how do, you know, what are their pay increases over the years? You know, when you have a bargaining contract in place, they get step increases. Or at least they negotiate. Not every bargaining contract has to have step increases. But that's how...
Well, we've not had a mechanism for our non-bargaining unit, non-management employees to ever move through the pay grade. This doesn't do it, but this gives us the foundation in order to be able to do it. And then I think at some later date, you're going to bring, if we approve this, you'll bring us that actual schedule that we approve. I mean, my ultimate goal, and I think we've all said this in one version or another, is to make sure that we treat all Story County employees in an equitable fashion, regardless of whether they're a member of a bargaining unit or not. And I think this is a very necessary step along those lines. And so I'm going to move approval of the classification and compensation policy for 7-day review.
Second.
We've got a motion and a second. I'll just add that over the past 5-plus years that we've had numerous discussions on this topic. I know Alyssa and I have spent quite a bit of time discussing this over the past couple, 3 years. It's been a goal of mine that we have some sort of a definitive scale or plan that employees can look at when they start here, to know that in 6 months I'll be here, in a year I'm going to be here. We've talked about being able to do this. For whatever reason, it's taken a little longer than I'd hoped, but I think the process is working the way it should, and I'm just happy that we've gotten.
Wait a minute, something in government took longer than you hoped.
Got to this point.
Shocking.
So that's what I have to say on that. I just want to thank Alyssa for all her hard work on this, and Wayne brought up a good point. It puzzles me sometimes how we got to this point before having a full-time human resource officer. So with that, I will call the question. Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Duke. Aye. That's been approved. Thank you again, Alyssa.
Yeah, I will email it out for comments and bring it back next week.
Okay. This would be discussion and consideration of performance management policy before the 7-day review.
Okay. It kind of goes in line with the classification and compensation policy. If you read through the comp policy, there were some items that stated that the employee evaluations needed to be done. The employees had to have satisfactory job performance. You know, that's one of the things we've talked about a lot over the last 4 or 5 years is any pay for performance measures there. We really want to get that top performance out of our employees, and how can we do that? We have to have a strong performance management policy. All this outlines is pretty much what we are currently doing. We do have employees that get evaluated. I think Noelle has worked really hard with the departments to get those turned in a timely fashion. She sends reminders out. I know supervisors don't like filling out those evaluations, but it is a really, really good tool for employees to see how they're performing. It's a good tool to get that communication between the supervisor and the employee. I know sometimes those discussions are hard to have. And so it outlines the actual performance appraisal, whether it be during our orientation period, annual from there on out. It also includes a session on a performance improvement plan. We have utilized this quite a bit since I have come on or taken this role. We just put a plan together for the employees, clearly state our expectations of what we have of them. You give them deadlines. You give them all the support you possibly can, whether they need more training, more guidance, and then it's up to the employee to improve their performance. We've had some that have been successful, and we've had some that haven't. But I think just having that in here with not only the actual written performance, but having that component in the performance management policy is very important.
Do you see this, if adopted, again, that we work with our management team, department head, staff, again, kind of a in-service review of, you know, what the expectations are, the goals, and what are the things here that we really need?
Yeah, actually, Noelle is working on updating some evaluation forms. The one we had that we actually implemented with our new compensation schedule is a great tool if you utilize merit raises. It gives you, it's a very, there's a lot of different components to it. I've heard it's pretty burdensome for some of the supervisors to fill out. So she's working on a different form that takes those same areas but kind of condenses it and makes it a little bit easier for them to do. I talked to her, she's going to put together a training so our supervisors know exactly how they evaluate employees because you know we don't want to overstate their performance. You don't want to understate. I mean, they have to be true and accurate evaluations that we give our employees. So there will be additional training coming out for those.
Okay. No other questions. I would move that we accept the performance management policy subject to a 7-day review.
Second. Got a motion and a second. Is there anything further? Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Tooth?
Aye.
That has been approved. And next we have discussion and consideration of self-funding dental through Delta Dental and setting the fiscal year 17 dental rates for plans 1 and 2, the same as the current rates for FY16. Again, still. And Debbie.
Every time I get my gold Jeep before then,
hopefully not. Oh.
That's what you need.
People are always telling me I need to smile more, so I need a reason to smile.
Okay. So in front of you, you do see the two Delta Dental plans. We've had discussions, probably 2 or 3 years, about self-insuring dental. Had discussions with Debbie. We've talked about it in budget work sessions. I think this is the year to do it. We were at another renewal with, we're currently with Principal Dental Insurance, and we were facing a 6% or so increase. The other thing that that we do with this is we were able to get the two is that, you know, we had them quote the two plans that we currently have. We don't have any benefit changes. Delta Dental is a very well-known insurance carrier for dental insurance. They have a very large network. We took the plan of the principal a couple years ago because Walmart kept increasing our premiums. And so self-insuring dental is a way we are hoping to kind of keep our premiums stable for dental insurance. I don't know if Debbie wants to add anything.
Not particularly, other than to say that
on a group of your size, it really always makes sense to self-fund dental. It is always the best, the most advantaged way to keep costs as flat as possible in dental, because it's such a statistical norm as to what percentage of people use their dental benefit.
So if we go to self-insurance, we can charge our employees the same premiums they paid last year, and we expect that that will be more than enough for us to be able to handle the self-insurance.
That's Delta's expectation, because they've taken...
Do you think that's reasonable?
I do, absolutely. Yeah. I think their analysis of looking at our claims over the last couple of years and looking at our plan design and their actuarial expectation that that is sufficient to fund our plan for the next fiscal year, I believe that's accurate.
Great. I'm struggling with the numbers. What does it cost for a teeth cleaning?
Depends on where you go.
Right.
But, you know, it can be, some would say I do it for $100. Some would say I do it for less. Some would say I do it for $150. It just really depends on who you see.
And so that's what I'm struggling with when I look at our expectation is, if I'm reading this right, and maybe I'm reading wrong, and help me, but so we've got X number of policyholders, and we're expecting to spend much, much less than one teeth cleaning would cost us for that group. Are you telling me that people are getting the insurance and then never going to get their teeth cleaned?
I'm telling you that there is absolutely a percentage of those who take the insurance that never have their teeth cleaned.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
That makes no sense at all to me.
Well,
it's what concerns me, because I look at this, and clearly what we're expecting to spend on an individual, what I look at plan two, and we would expect our cost, if I'm reading it right, including all the administration fees, to be, $28 a month for an individual?
No, that's a recommended rate. We're actually setting the rate up. We are recommending setting the rates at the current rate, which is higher than $28. I think their recommended rates, deltas, are a little low for first-year self-funding. They're basing it on the census that we have, past claims. From year to year, you don't know how many orthodontic benefits you're going to have. I mean, they can take a look at your population now. That could change July 1st. So you have to, you know, figure in a little bit. Principal had our rates set based on, they were going to go up 6% based on utilization, different things, because we are fully insured. The nice part of being fully insured is if your claims are higher than your what you take in for premiums, the insurance carrier has to pay for that. Although they're going to catch up, you're going to pay for it in the next few years as they give you your increases.
Yeah, long term, really much smaller organizations than the county fare very well with self-funded dental. Like you just indicated, you could certainly have a bad year or two because you could have an influx in orthodontic claims, or you could run at 80% instead of 60%, no question. But over a five-year average?
Do we have any dollars in reserve for this? Didn't we carve some out?
We carved some out and budgeted some. Yeah. To start us out, we had a reserve to pay claims until we start getting...
What do we have in reserve? We have $100,000 reserve, and you feel like that's more than enough? I mean, it doesn't look like our expected costs are going to approach that.
Right. And like Alyssa said, our expected cost, we may be higher than what Delta has suggested for year one. That's why we're being really conservative with it.
But we're able to maintain what employees paid last year. So
correct.
It's
our
no
employees won't
increase
see an increase.
They won't see an increase.
Yes.
All right. So I'm going to move approval of self-funding through Delta Dental.
Second. We have a motion and a second to move to self-funded dental plan through Delta.
As presented.
Anything further? Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Two. Aye. Everybody go get your teeth cleaned.
Well, no, actually, you don't want to.
You don't want them. I don't know why you'd take the dental. I don't know why you take the dental insurance.
I'm
going to
go on
the
limb and say, yeah, get your teeth. Well, most people start out because they have a problem, and then they recommended on regular checkups. Like I went because years ago I had a problem with my dentist and gum and teeth, and and now I just automatically for 6 months. Yeah, I go.
It's the same with health insurance.
I was really interested when
the older you get, it becomes more important because your chief, you know.
The sheriff and our detention officer were here, and they told us that the highest suicide rate, professional suicide rate, is among the detention officers. I'd always heard it was among deaths.
Okay.
Next is discussion. You're done, right?
I'm done.
Okay. Good job. Discussion and consideration of cemetery training. Leanne Harder.
Gee, don't ask me to go with him.
I was going to say good morning. It's good afternoon.
It is somewhere in the world.
Before you is a memo I did put on the agenda. As the board knows, over the past few years, a couple of years, through the Township Trustees annual meeting that Auditor Martin puts together, they've put the trustees have mentioned need for cemetery training. There was some cemetery training scheduled this year, and I think the consensus was it didn't at least meet the needs or the anticipated expectations. So I reached out, and I did this about a year ago, too, to SAPIC, which is the State Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries, seeing if they had some experts that could come in and provide some cemetery training for township trustees. They have jumped all over it. They have some members that are professional consultants that have already sent me their bios and proposals. And so what I have before you is just some draft figures and requesting that the board consider finding $1,500 next fiscal year, so starting July 2016, to schedule a cemetery training. We'll get the right individuals in, hold it for a maximum of 25 individuals, which should more than adequately cover it, do both a classroom and an on-site cemetery training, too. Do you have questions?
I know that the discussion has been had with the trustees. I know that the training that we lined up this year, although it was good training, it probably missed the mark for what our trustees were looking for. And they did mention the gal that put on the presentation this year did mention that the State Association for the Preservation would be the people to talk to with some of the more specific questions that some of the trustees had. So I think it's something that the trustees have been asking for, and I think it's a reasonable amount of money.
I think it's $1,500 well spent if we can hit the mark
this
time.
Yeah.
And so I want to move approval.
Okay.
Second.
So I have a motion and a second to approve the funding. Is it up to $1,500?
Up to $1,500.
For cemetery
training.
Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Two. Aye. That's been approved.
And so, again, we'll target that for early fall before harvest season begins so we can get our audience in here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Discussion and direction regarding financing the design, construction, and facilitation of certain improvements and other work to serve the park portion of Phase 3, Story County Conservation Board Park, as described in the approved agreement for public improvements and other work pertaining to the Iowa State University Research Park, Phase 3, Leanne Harder. And Mike Cox is unavailable. He's on a conference call with the Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, and Steve Carter from the Research Park called and indicated he would be willing to be here. And what I told him is, at least as I understand it, this is simply laying out how we're going to go through making decisions. This is not making decisions.
Right.
This is an opportunity for the board to follow up on your action in mid-February where you approved the agreement with Iowa State University Research Park to be a key partner with the Story County Conservation Park. To follow up that decision with the signed agreement as to now you're committed to doing these improvements over the next 4 years, how do you want to finance those? What mechanisms would you like staff to research and bring back to you with a time frame? Probably rather more sooner rather than later, because that window of those improvements being needed has started with the signature of the agreement.
Yeah, I actually think this is an easy conversation. It may not be an easy decision,
right,
but it's an easy conversation. And I think that conversation is, we run this just like we ran the Dakin's Lake conversation for funding. We run it through the entire TIF process, which I believe is about a three-month process, isn't it, Leanne?
Yeah.
About a three-month process to decision with multiple public input points. But you look at this, we don't have $1.2 million in the budget to do this next year, or 1.1 the year after that. This is the one mechanism that we have. It very clearly is directly economic development related, in that they're talking about going from 1,800 jobs to 6,000 jobs in the research park. And there is some tangible county property that would be associated with this. So I feel really, really comfortable, again, not with where the decision might end up, but in following that process to make a decision.
And I had the pleasure of sitting in a meeting a couple weeks ago with Mike Cox and members of the Conservation Board, members of the DOT, Iowa State University Research Components, DNR. People are really excited about coming to the table, looking at the project, the scope of what this can do in terms of using it as a laboratory for best practices and water quality initiatives as well. And the university already has students assigned and working with the conservation in some of the design and work of this nature. So I see it. I was very impressed with the folks around the table. There was discussion about as we move forward and put together some type of an RFP for the type of things, whether some of those would be willing to, sit in and take a look at that as somewhat of a framework of a committee. But I think Mike just did an excellent job of really hounding the core issues that the Conservation Board had approved, and the fact that we had gotten tremendous concession from the research park in being able to move this project to a position that is a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, Wayne, and I haven't heard anybody question with any vehemence at all the outstanding impact that the research park will have to Ames and Story County. I have heard people question, why is the county getting involved? I mean, we're a small-time player in this. It's a, what, $60 million project, and we're talking about having about $3 million of that. Why is the county involved? But where I think there does need to be some very reasonable, deep conversation is, okay, if the county is involved, and which we've said we are, and if we're going to spend about $3 million over the next 4 years, which we've agreed that we were going to do, where's that money coming from?
Right.
What's a reasonable way to pay for it? How does that impact the citizens of Story County? And making that decision, and that's what I think our conversation is here today. How do we go through making that decision?
Well, I'm the one that's probably come along a little slower than you two gentlemen on this, and we did vote unanimously here a month or so ago to enter into the agreement with the
other entities to move forward with this,
and so I'm just going to tell you, you're just going to have to pull me along as we go, because
yep.
it's going to be this. There'll be some interesting conversations about the funding process.
Well, do you see another place, Paul? So I get it. I mean, I get what your concerns are. I think the concerns are really, really reasonable. Is there some other direction we can? So I've thrown out to Leanne, let's look at it through the TIF funding process. Clearly, we can get to the end of that process and say, no, we're not doing it. I don't think that alleviates our responsibility to do it. And so do you have another area you'd like her to be looking at as another possible funding source? I don't have
right.
I said all the way through that I thought it was a TIF.
No, right? Like you said, we don't have $1.2 million laying around for us to spend on this year and over a million in the future. I do think it's a reasonable. I do think it's a good use of those TIF dollars. We just have to be prepared for the discussions that we're going to have in the future. And I think one of the best items that we put together, or you had put together, was the map showing the valuations in Story mm-hmm. County. Granted, we spent a similar amount of money in Zering. The argument's going to be, well, that's where the wind towers are at, and that's where the money should be spent. You take a look at the valuations map that you had our GIS coordinator draw up. It clearly shows that the vast majority of the valuations on property in Story County lie west of the interstate. Mm-hmm. So,
well, yeah, I mean, either we're one county or we're not one county.
Exactly.
So my suggestion would be, Leanne, take an outline for us what the date certain on an entire TIF process. Let's publish the heck out of it. Let's make sure that everybody's really, really aware of that three-month span that we've got to take certain steps and where any decision points would be. The last thing in the world we want to do is have any of these people that I think Paul rightly points out that are going to question utilizing those dollars, have them suggest that they were not part of the conversation.
I will likely come back next week then with the existing urban renewal area plan with some draft changes, not for you to take action on.
Right.
The action I will seek is approval of the time frame that you just mentioned, and then approval of the time frame that includes the publishing the changes I bring next week. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it makes sense to me that the first thing that we would put out is a time frame, and then we would talk about where the information is coming in from, how that's being shared, and then ultimately a decision point.
Yeah, this was not a consideration.
No, my question is and then are you looking at another meeting the following week? I'm trying to look at the board meeting dates in April, first 2 weeks. Purview of a conversation you and I had a little bit earlier, but we were going to talk about this. So.
Yeah.
Okay, I can talk to you about that one.
I would prefer that to occur next week, in tandem with it. Not in tandem, because this would be on it. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. I have a contact I need you to make for me.
Okay. So you're clear.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. How's the call going?
Perfect time on Mr. Cox. Okay. Other reports. That's going to take us down to discussion of draft secondary road construction program 2017 to 2021. Darren Moon.
Discussion of the five-year construction program for secondary roads. As we do every year, I present the draft program and ask for any changes the board might have, and then we'll let it kind of sit for a week for public comment, and I'll put it on the agenda again for next week for final approval. I'll skip through some of this introductory stuff. You've all been through the process many times now. We're required by April 15th of each year to submit this program to the DOT. Many factors in selecting the projects, and most importantly, the cost. I'll point out that we start out with the local part of our budget. We kind of have two different parts. We have local and then extra funding. This is the local side of last year. You approved this for local funds. We had seven projects. All seven were completed except for the Maxwell Bridge, which has been let. But some of it could fall in 16, but majority probably paid out of 17. So you'll see that project there carry over into FY17, which we just approved. We have three projects in 17. The first one is the carryover project, and then the West 190th Bridge, and then Grant Avenue paving.
This is the form the DOT wants the program submitted in. I did print that out for you. That was part of the agenda, though. If you want to look at it, it's on the agenda. An easier form to look at is what you have in front of you. Laying out, starting with the road side, we'll do the bridges next, but starting on roads, I'll just point out the changes to last year. First of all, if you look far left side, if it has a program here, that means it's in the program. And beyond that, these are just our wish projects. The first new one is in 2018. That's 530th Avenue or University Extension down to 260th Avenue. It's just 3/4 mile grade and pave. Kind of extends on what the university did by the research park with the roundabouts. It takes it down to 260th. That road gets a lot of traffic, 340, and that might even be low. New traffic counts come out here real soon, but I haven't been in time for this meeting. I expect that to be higher than 340.
Is that our heaviest gravel stretch?
Just one of them.
Just one of them. I believe, well, that has been. It's been up and down because before R38 got improved, it was even higher, and then it went down a little bit since R38 was improved. Okay. But with ISU's facilities out there, it's going back up. This next new one is in 2018 also, and that's West 190th. That's the Prairie Moon Winery Road. We're replacing that bridge structure hopefully next year, and then I'd like to overlay that whole stretch. It's rough condition, and then it's a pretty big cutout to do that bridge, and that's going to settle, and it's going to need an overlay anyway on that, the bridge portion that we replaced.
Where's the gravel start? Tell me, is it between bridges that the gravel starts?
Yeah, well, I'm proposing all the way from G.W. Carver past the winery, and then it curves to the north about 1/4 mile. It's more than paved. It's just steel coat now.
You would go across the bridge and up, but you wouldn't go down to the long bridge that we're talking about closed.
No, just put an overlay on what's steel coated right now.
Okay.
And the last one at the bottom of the page, number 15, 260th Avenue, that's in addition to our wish list. If we extend University down to 260th, then at some point it makes sense to me that we take it over west to R38. We have a lot of people that cut across Zumwalt right now. I think they would cut across on 260th if it was paved.
Yep,
to get over to that southern area. Research Park area, especially.
That gives us almost a southern bypass, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, we had in the program to pave University straight down to what we call E57, the Kelly pavement. But to me, it makes more sense to cut it over to R38 sooner than that.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, but I think we ought to explore that a little further.
Because was it? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I believe that So since we put money in the budget to pave Grant north into Guilford, I've been contacted by two developers. I don't know if you guys have.
No.
They didn't contact me at all before we put it in, but since we put it in, now all of a sudden, you know, it's, if you build it, they will come kind of thing. There's real interest in building some more residences on the just out of Guilford. They'll be in Guilford ultimately, but south of Guilford, mainly because we're going to pave this stretch of road. So my question then is, Iowa State owns all the land, really, just south of Ames. I mean, it's tough to think about any development south of Ames with Iowa State. But you get down around Kelly, and all of a sudden you've got some more private ground that there could be some development on. And that would be my only real rationale, is what kind of economic development would it do if you took University all the way south to the Kelly Blacktop? Now, I think I'm with you. I think cutting over on 260th is the way to go. But I'm not sure we've done all the analysis we need to do on that.
It's no longer in there, so yeah, I put that in so you have the numbers anyway, what it would cost to go straight south.
Yeah,
and maybe you're aware of it, but somehow my mind was telling me that conservation was talking about at one time extending a trail. And I don't know whether it was...
Yeah, so there's an old railroad bed land that runs basically from the research park diagonally down toward the down toward the dairy farm.
Right.
And conservation is working on having a trail coming out of there. They've also, Iowa State has not agreed to the specific route, but has agreed in principle to run a trail from what will be the research park all the way over to South Dakota.
Right.
But and so there's
but somehow, recently I had thought that University Avenue was mentioned if it was ever going to be paved south to have a bike trail or a park.
Well, that would be that diagonal that I'm talking about. It would be off street.
Okay.
And then there would also be a trail, I think, Darren, if I'm not mistaken, on the north side of 260th that runs west over toward R38.
Yeah.
Sounds right. So lots of conversation and conservation has been part of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are we to the point that I get to say what's not on there that needs to be on there?
Yes, I'm done with what the additions were until, you know, I found out more about the Highway 30 situation.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I'm going. It's time for 600 to be on there. It's time. 600 is now a farm to market. We got dollars in the farm to market. I think that there is no time in the foreseeable future that we're going to see DOT close. Close access right there. I think it's time for us to get in and pay 600 for that mile between Highway 30 and Lincoln Highway.
It's interesting where these conversations have ended up.
Well, you had it on the 5-year calendar, 10 years ago?
600?
Yeah.
No.
It was in there at some point.
It's been more recent than that.
More recent. It was taken off for some reason. Yeah.
It was taken off.
Because of the DOT conversation. But I think even when we took it off, we said if these DOT conversations ever stall or go away, we recognize that that's going to be a major north-south thoroughfare to get to this industrial area. So I think it's time that we put it in the schedule. I think it's time we get it in the schedule as quickly as we can do it based on our ability to do it. It looks to me like we've got money in the farm to market account to be able to pay for something like that.
Yeah, we'll go over our account balances at the end here, and we can decide what year you want in there. Just give you a quick snapshot. That's a little hard to read. The pavement age we have out there now, I break it into PC payments and HMA payments. Anything in yellow here is in the program now. Nothing for PCs in the program. 1980 is our oldest one. We just did two of our really old PCs last year, so our PC payments are in okay shape, but most of our HMAs, like I said, the yellow ones are in the program. This E18 was an old DOT road, so it was built a little bit thicker, so it's lasted a little bit longer. I put some numbers together. Have you seen these before? Right now we're kind of at, we need about $2 million a year to maintain our payments, and we are getting in about 1.4, so we're a little bit behind the curve still, even after the road use tax increase. Some point that'll catch up to us.
Yep.
Yellow are the paving that are in the program. This also includes stuff we're doing this current year, so it's not in the 5-year program because we don't show 2016 in there, but these four are in 2016. The new ones to this would be 530th right here. And then what's 190th right here. And these are our wish list paving. I kept that stretch in the wish list, but then maybe extend, but then I'll put some numbers together to take that straight down. Compare those two. The new interchange proposal might put less emphasis on South S if we have an interchange on 6th where people can get on 30. That might decrease that, and then 600 be more of an emphasis now, so we'll get that added.
I like, so I see 13th Street coming out of Ames, talking about taking that all the way over. What is that, the 600? Is where you got that going?
That's
through?
Where we have it. That's been in the program for a long, or wish list for a long time. I know Jane always really wanted that done, and just never able to come up with the funding to do it. But, yeah.
That's been on there a long time. We put a lot of rock on that road. It gets a lot of truck traffic coming.
I think that one makes a whole lot of sense.
Where is the turn to the co-op there by the ethanol plant? Which one is that?
It ends there on the east side. This
is the new.
And so I'm thinking like 13th Street Extension, and you can turn there.
Yep. Yeah, you can come out 13th and come all the way across to just beyond the co-op.
But you wouldn't go, why wouldn't?
Well, this has the railroad. You can get across the railroad here, so we
cross
thought
the railroad there. Why would you consider going all the way to S14 that goes?
Well, there's no straight way through.
No, I know. I see what you're saying. Yeah, because it curves and goes around. Yep.
Talk to me about the two up by Gilbert.
Yeah, well, this would be 180th. We put the new Peterson Pitt Bridge in, but with the topography, it'd be very expensive. I think $3 million we show to pave that. This one gets a West 170th gets a little bit more traffic because of the horticulture farm out there. That's one of our highest traffic counts we have.
Well, and I think there's an opportunity there to get Iowa State to participate in whatever cost there could be. So if there's value to the county to pay something like that and we can get some help paying for it, it may be worth fully exploring that.
Yeah, and that is a Farnham Market Road, and so is 180th. They're both Farnham Market Roads. That's it for the paving discussion. We'll talk about 600 a little bit at the end. Move on to bridges. That slide hasn't changed much. It just we a little additional money for our federal bridge funding with the new bill that was passed, federal bill. $337 per year.
Go back, because I thought we were 283 bridges. Why are we only 276 bridges?
It depends how you count the county line bridges and the ones we have that's shared with cities.
Yeah, I just want to know. When I throw a number out there, I want to know where I got it.
Depends how you count them. Then this is Washington Post article shows why we have the problems, most dangerous bridges in the country. You see a lot of red around Iowa in particular. So
that's the first.
And the chart I show you every year, these are our newest bridges the past 10 years. We're making a little ground, replacing more and more bridges, but this is the problem. These are all of our wood bridges, and then our old, really old concrete bridges. They're all kind of come and due at the same time.
How many bridges, Kyle?
A lot of wood bridges out there left. Bridge replacements the last 20 years. The yellows are the ones we did at major fixes too, but then replaced them, and the blue ones are the ones that we actually replaced. It was about 50 in the past 20 years. So if you run the numbers on that, that if you use the past 20 years as an example, that about 115 years every bridge has to last at that pace. But I would point out we are addressing a lot of our shorter bridges up front because they're easier to fix, and post a bridge, it's better to address the small ones first. But the more we get into it, we're going to get into longer bridges. Some of our fixes are trying to get those wood bridges to last as long as possible. We're doing some new splices, putting concrete around some of them, get a little bit more life out of them. Restricting the outside edges, doing that in a few locations. First thing I look at is the bridges on Farnham Market routes. This is the map from 2 to 3 years ago. We had 19 on here that were load posted on Farnham Market routes. The ones with yellow on ones we were going to address in the near future in the program. The map looks much better now. We're down to the ones with yellow on them. Those four are actually getting replaced this year. That takes us just to a handful of Farnham Market bridges that will be posted, and almost all of these have been addressed recently, so that they're not a real they have a lot more life in them that way, even though they might be posted. They've had repairs to them. It'd probably be these over here. If we have extra Farnham Market money, I'd look at adding one of these. But again, we're getting to the point where we're looking at our longer bridges now. All three of those are fairly long. So more cost.
And then this is what's actually in the program. The purple ones are the current year, FY 17 or 16, and this is the 17 bridge here. And then the yellow ones are the new, well, years 2 through 5. Let me point out the new additions to it. There's four of them that are new. Sandhill Trail has been an issue for us with bridges. So actually, these are both new ones. We replaced one down further south last year, but we have two other ones that are bad. This north one's a little bit longer. Let me do that. That's in a dip, and it's 40 foot long. It'll probably be $400,000 to $500,000 bridge. For some reason, it's in a FEMA detailed study area. I don't know why. It's not a very large stream. So to meet those requirements, it's going to take a pretty good sized bridge.
Where is this?
Sandhill Trail.
Oh, okay.
Let's look underneath it. It's a two-span bridge, and the problem is these steel beams are rusted so bad. The outside ones are rusted worse, but we had to post it finally. And it needs the other abutment back wall is undercut and it's in worse shape. I don't have a picture of that, but it's time it needs to go. We were surveying it last week, and the guy landowner said we were out there surveying it 20 years ago to get it replaced. So it never got on the program, but I wasn't aware of that. This is the other Sandhill Trail one. This is just south of the intersection of 260th. You can see the temporary repairs we were buying some life with, but it keeps eroding and undercutting the back wall. But this would take a box culvert. It wouldn't be terribly expensive, so it's one we need to address.
But you got this, you got the other one in the program for 18.
Yes. That one I see is the more critical one.
Right. You don't have this one with the box culvert in.
That is in 2019 on the second page. First one on the second page. Yeah, the ones that say new under the length column are the ones, that, the new additions to the program. And the next new one's in 2020, and that's the Sherman 33 Bridge on 210th Street. So there's a map where the other two are. That's this one over here. And the other new one is Collins 2, yeah, right down here. It'd be the, that's another small bridge. Those are the four new additions. Unfortunately, none of those are on the farm market system. Yeah, these farm market funds. Mm-hmm. Then we get to our bridge wants. I have photos of all the bridges that are in the program. Okay, and this list, as you know, is the list of bridges that are possible closure candidates in the future. The first one actually dropped off from last year. That was 248th Street. We did close that bridge. We have not removed that yet. It's been a pretty busy winter for us. Hopefully next winter we'll have some free time. We can actually get that bridge removed. And the only new one added to our wants list would be the Squaw Valley Bridge off of West 190th over here. If we decide to close that stretch through here and close that bridge, be a good candidate after we get the one over here replaced.
Yeah, we just got to get that one to get us through.
There's a lot of subdivision traffic that's going to have to take that way to get out. Yeah.
But I don't want, so this is all a new subdivision over here on the left side of the screen. I don't want the people that are moving in there to get used to using 190th, because then we've got a room full of people when we decide that we're not spending $1.2 million to replace that bridge. Yep.
These are all the bridges that potential closure. Rock discussion, I won't talk about that long this year, because in the past I talked how we could use farm to market money to put rock on our roads, but the fuel tax increases put less strain on our local side of our budget, so I think we're good there, but it's always an option in the future.
Hey, educate me on rock. Why are we not buying rock, or maybe we are, from the quarry right here at Highway 30 and I-35?
That rock is very expensive. One of it's the gradation. They have they don't have a lot of sand mixed in with it. The stuff we buy at our gravel pits is probably $450 a ton. We got those quoted once. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it seemed like it was $18 to $22 a ton or something.
Really?
I think because they weren't mixing a lot of sand with it, and I don't know.
It's a lot of river rock, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good, strong rock, but it's expensive.
Huh. It's good around the foundation of your house.
I don't know they have a lot of it either. We'd go through what they had pretty quickly if we did buy it, but the cost is... But we have chickens. We do buy our snow and ice control sand from there, but we haven't bought aggregate from that pit.
Yep.
That brings us to our worksheet of our fund balances, other than our local fund balance. So our other funds are Barnum Market, SDPs are federal aid road dollars, and the BRS is the federal aid bridge dollars. So the yellow are the monies coming in. And the middle part is the expenditures, what we have coming out. And then over on the right side is the balance. Doing pretty good with the BRS, keeping that balance down. We want to use that money. And we are at a negative number. We can borrow ahead a few years, so that's not an issue. We want to be borrowed ahead, because if you get a three-year balance, they will take money away from you. So you want to make sure you keep that spent. STP has a little bit of a balance in it in 17, but it just take one overlay project. We can only spend that money on federal aid roads, which are pretty much our paved roads already, so it's just maintaining pavements with that money. And Farm to Market's the one that still has a little bit of balance there in the future, and I left some room, depending what came about with the Highway 30 discussion, if we needed to add some pavement for that. And it sounds like 600 is going to be a candidate now for paving. Really, you can borrow ahead in that fund a couple years too, so we can pretty much add 600 in wherever you'd like, but it's going to take time to design and buy right away and all that. So 18 might be the earliest we could really realistically get it. It would depend on how right-of-way negotiations went, if they went real smoothly.
Well, does it put too much on your plate if we shoot for doing 670?
One of the issues we're going to have to, being farm market money, we had let through the DOT, so we got to follow their letting schedule, and that's a lot harder to meet than local dollars only. I gotta think about that a little bit, and I can report back next time.
All right, yeah, I just like to get it on there since the dollars aren't an issue. I'd like to get it on there as soon as we can reasonably get it on there. And then the second thing I'm going to suggest is that we pull two of the local bridges, local dollar bridges, from 18 and pull them up into 17. And I'm not really worried about it. So in my mind, there's three bridges there that I'd just soon pull two of them. Either 1590 or 250 at Fox Culvert, or the 645th Pike Culvert. Like I said, two of those three, just pull them up into 17 and get them done. And I like the flexibility that gives us down the road. Now, what I'm suggesting for that one, Darren, is that this board would put general fund dollars covering those two bridges in addition to what we budgeted. We put about $200,000 additional money in to pull those two bridges forward. I like the way the map's looking with us working through our bridges. We're never going to get to the end of this. It's like trying to hold the ocean back with a spoon. So all we can do is try to get ahead anytime we can. And the reality is, FY17, we can find $200,000 to go do two more bridges. At least that's what I believe.
So you mentioned five names moving ahead. What was
so I've got from the 2018 right. schedule, you got 590th and then skip San Diego Trail and go 250th and 645th. I'm saying I'd like to see two of those three roll up in 17, and we would this board would have to plug the dollars in. And Darren, if I'm misstating something, tell me now. But I think if the board just plugs in an additional $200,000 above what we budgeted for you, that gives you capacity to do something.
Right. And it's probably the first two. The 645th is a pipe project that isn't the type of priority, so I'm going to do the bridges first. Yeah,
so the way I see that, that's $190,000 estimate.
Great.
Yeah.
I think it'll be interesting to see how the traffic unfolds when this ethanol plant finally gets to cooking. And you can see, obviously, where they're stockpiling the large square bales on 590th south of Lincoln Way. That's apparently going to be the permanent staging site for these bales that are going to get fed into the plant. So, and I was happy to see that the City of Ames wants to take the entire length of the Lincoln Highway. So that'll take it out of ours.
Yeah, this the 590th bridge in the program here. This is north, just south of E-29.
Right.
So it's not that one.
Yeah.
Just one of the better.
Is this the one that bounces?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say let's get that one replaced. Darren, am I putting too much on your plate?
No, those are doable.
Deb, we're going to have to work with Lisa Markley so that we can identify the dollars that Darren brings those two bridges for, because this is dollars in excess to what we put in there so far. Right, all we put in this year was the minimum required in order for us to leverage everything that comes from the feds to state, which I think we talked about at that time, that just because we're only plugging in the minimum doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to just stick with the minimum. That's what I'm suggesting we do here.
Well, I'll make those changes and then post our draft on our website, map, and the program itself, and send, see if there's any public comments to next week, and come back to the board next week for final approval.
Okay. Good job.
Thank you, Darren.
Let's see. So this is notification. We'll do the public hearing on this next week.
We don't do an official public hearing for the program.
Just got it.
Just for approval, and we had turned in the DOT by the 15th. We don't need to hold the hearing.
Good.
Okay. That takes us to public forum number two. Comments from the public on items not on the agenda. The board may not take any actions on the comments or the requirements of the open meeting law, but may do so in the future. Loris is shaking her head no, so...
I don't even recognize Loris without her table. Where's your table, Loris?
I think we're clear.
I have to bring it up
tonight. Liaison assignments and committee meeting updates. Wayne Clinton.
Pass.
Rick?
No, thanks.
I'll pass. Announcements from the supervisor.
Wayne. Wayne, we get past 4 o'clock and you're not going to announce anything?
You got anything to say? Come on.
All right, I'm done too.
All right, give me a motion for adjournment.
I move that we adjourn.
I need a second for that.
Second.
You got a motion, a second, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned.
Good job.
Yeah.